This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where we take a couple topics that don't quite fit into a full show and put them on your plate. But my favorite part of the Pitch-In is catching up on the week in Indiana news with our venerable Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, it's so nice to be venerable.
you are the venerable member of the team. So this week was a rough week for the Indiana Attorney General, or was it? He seemed to hold his own in front of the Indiana State Supreme Court a couple times.
Yeah. This week, Curtis Hill had his disciplinary hearing. So essentially, the disciplinary hearing was established to determine whether or not he should face any consequences if he violated code of conduct rules from the Indiana Supreme Court for attorneys in the state. So for 4 days, a former justice for the Indiana Supreme Court heard testimony from the state or from the disciplinary commission and from the attorney general and his attorneys. Basically to establish whether or not he has violated code of conduct rules, for attorneys in the state.
And this is, of course, all stemming from the groping allegation.
Yes.
That's why we're here.
Yes. From the March 2018 groping allegations for a post-session party at AJ's bar, where four accusers, three legislative staffers and a state representative accused the attorney general of various forms of harassment.
And so what was heard at the testimony? What did he say? What did others say?
Yeah. So each of the four accusers testified, recounting their experiences, Hill's behavior, and the legislative leaders' responses. We also heard testimony from the legislative leaders, from lobbyists who were at that party, from other legislators that were at that party, all documenting what they saw, what they experienced of Hill's behavior. And for the first time, we also heard Curtis Hill tell his side of the story and how he recounted those allegations.
So everyone in the same room.
Everyone in the same room. And with the additional bit of one of Hill's former employees, a victim advocate for the Elkhart County Prosecutor's Office, also testified with new allegations against the attorney general from before he became the attorney general. According to her testimony, Hill used explicit language saying that, and I will censor myself, that we need to F because it would be hot. So essentially,
wow.
Yeah. So essentially, all of this testimony kind of comes together. And this was in the original filing for the disciplinary commission, that this is establishing a pattern of behavior from Hill, that he is interacting with female co-workers, colleagues, et cetera, in a way that is not befitting an attorney in the state of Indiana.
And so when we get to this point where we're in front of the Indiana State Supreme Court, I mean, it's serious business. And so these accusers are saying that this happened. And so no one's taking it back or anything like that. How did he respond?
Yeah. Essentially, he basically went, allegation by allegation and, made. I told his side of how those interactions happened. So, one of the things that Hill was accused of was touching women inappropriately. And from his perspective, he says that he has hearing loss in both ears and that at a crowded bar, he was leaning in closer. He was touching people to let them know that he was going to move in closer. So he during his testimony, attempted to respond to each of those allegations in that way, or flat out denying that certain things happened. So, for example, one of the lawmakers, Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, is the one who said that Hill grabbed her butt and a handful by her recount of events. And Curtis Hill straight up says, Nope, that did not happen. She said that she confronted him when that happened and used explicit language to tell him to back off. And during his testimony, he said that also did not happen, that that confrontation did not happen. So this is the first time that we've heard Hill's side of events. Reporters had asked for his side of things, and he had said no. Additionally, when he was testifying, he mentioned that when this memo, the memo that was put together by legislative leaders to determine if they had any culpability for workplace harassment as a result of these allegations, that memo was leaked to the Indianapolis Star. And when that happened, Curtis Hill, according to his testimony, basically said, you know, he was concerned that this was a political hit, essentially.
So 4 days of this at the Indiana State Supreme Court.
Yeah.
That seems like a lot. I don't know if it's enough, but what happens next?
Yeah. So and it was definitely a lot for the State House reporters who were covering and tweeting it.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Shout out to Brandon Smith and Fort Wayne's own Nikki Kelly
Both of whom are going to be on Monday's show talking about exactly this. We'll unpack it a little bit more.
Definitely. And so as far as what happens next, it will be months before a final decision comes in the disciplinary case. If Curtis Hill faces any sort of disciplinary action from all of this testimony, it could range from a letter of reprimand to him being disbarred. So the consequences are pretty dire at the, you know, far end of the spectrum. At the other end, you know, not much at all. and after hearing from 26 witnesses, the hearing officer, the former state Supreme Court Justice Myra Selby, will make a recommendation as to what should happen. And then whoever doesn't like Selby's recommendation will petition the Indiana Supreme Court to review the case. All five justices will make the final decision. But that could be well into 2020 before they make any sort of decision.
And when it comes to the hearing this week, from what I've read and from what I've kind of heard, it seems like he's been playing it pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like just trying to maybe sort of downplay the tone, or maybe he's just trying to be all business about it.
Yeah. I mean, he hasn't spoken to the media about his side of things. He hasn't been addressing this head on. And I think that is definitely an intentional tactic that he's not trying to bring attention to something like this because, it's going to ebb and flow as, you know, news does.
All right. We got a couple more to get through. Let's talk about the ArcelorMittal cyanide and ammonia spill that occurred near Indiana Dunes National Park. Mm-hmm. What do we know now?
Yeah. So the spill occurred on August 11th. And it was caused by an equipment failure. And so what we've learned recently, earlier this week, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, IDEM, released a report from an investigation into that spill. And so we learned a couple of things from that. One, we learned that this was part of that something else had happened before.
In sort of the same area where that we can trace this spill back to, right, as I understand it?
Yeah, that there was an additional issue that, you know, may or may not have, you know, led to this spill part of a week earlier. But what this incident definitely shows for sure is that ArcelorMittal was having issues and that they didn't communicate those issues with IDEM, which is what they were supposed to do. The other thing that we learned was so IDEM puts out this report and ArcelorMittal responded to it basically saying that they don't agree with all of the facts and conclusions in IDEM's report. But they said that they are, going to work with regulators to prevent similar incidents in the future.
All right. Well, it seems like it's not quite over yet, but we're getting there.
Getting there.
iLearn. So iLearn is in the news again. Let's can you tell me quick what iLearn is in case people don't know?
Yeah, it's the new standardized test that replaces iStep Plus that replaced iStep the original.
Okay. And So the scores, I guess, there's something about the scores and how they won't be applied
yes.
to teacher accountability scores?
Yeah. So it all started when we released the iLearn scores. Essentially, they were really, really low, which is fairly common when standardized tests are changed. Kids are super flexible. That's the great thing about kids. But when you mess with a standardized test, those test scores tend to drop fairly significantly. And that's exactly what happened with iLearn. But because Indiana's funding formulas for schools, the school accountability and teacher accountability, which is tied into funding, because standardized testing is such a part of that, there needed to be legislative action to basically hit the pause button so that they didn't face consequences for things that were entirely out of their control. So legislative leaders earlier this week basically outlined their plan to navigate teacher accountability and iLearn scores. So they reached out. They basically made recommendations to the Indiana Department of Education and the State Board of Education as to how to hold harmless, which is the official term for that, things like teacher appreciation grants, which the deadline is December. The legislature doesn't meet again until the beginning of January. But what we also learned is that they are planning on basically fast-tracking any sort of legislative response to hold harmless. The governor's on board. The legislative leaders are on board. Everyone's pretty much on board to say, hey, we get it. Like, this wasn't anyone's fault or issue. And, you know, we'll see what happens with the next round of iLearn scores.
That was going to be my next question is, what if this happens again next year? Do you think the same thing is going to happen? Do you know what happened when iStep turned to iStep Plus? Was it a 2-year or was it just a 1-year? We're going to throw these out when it comes to teacher accountability and school grades.
It was 1 year of hold harmless. But the other thing is with standardized testing, the important thing is to know that you can't. It's very difficult to compare standardized tests to a different standardized test. And so if you're comparing, it's like comparing apples and oranges. You need to compare apples to apples. And so what next year's iLearn scores are going to be able to do is have lawmakers, have teachers, have school administrators compare apples to apples as opposed to apples to oranges.
You may know this, you may not, but does changing the test factor into this? Do they change the test itself? Or is it just where they look at the results?
Not necessarily. iLearn was developed to cut down on the amount of test time for students to make it a little bit easier. It's an adaptive test. It's an online test. So those were a lot of changes at once. And the way that lawmakers are talking, the way that education officials are talking, the test is fine. You just have to let kids get used to it.
Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman, thanks for filling us in.
Happy to be here as always.
Up next, we will hear more about the Indiana Manufacturing Survey for 2019 with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton. And we'll also talk UAW. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we move on, I want to tell you about yesterday's show. We had a fascinating discussion about the continued evolution of the hemp industry in Indiana with hemp advocates, the people testing and researching the crops, and we talked with a farmer who's been trying to get into the hemp game for years and finally put in his first crop this year. You can hear that show wherever you get podcasts. And right now we're going to talk about the 2019 Indiana Manufacturing Survey, which provides insights into the trends we're seeing across the state in this field. Even in the face of a possible economic slowdown, the survey suggests that the manufacturing sector is healthy, although it does identify challenges deserving of attention. Indiana Public Broadcasting's business reporter Samantha Horton joins us now to break it down. Sam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
For starters, can you explain what the annual manufacturing survey is? For those of us who aren't familiar?
Yeah, so it's been going on for several years. It's been going on for over 10 years. And what it does is it surveys the manufacturing industry here in Indiana. And that's a variety. That can be your small companies as well as your large ones and varies in different industry sectors. So it goes from automobile to aerospace and even fashion. So it's really trying to capture a variety of groups within the manufacturing industry and what they see as issues that are presenting for them in their shops.
So who's included? Any big, what are the big names, I guess?
That's not necessarily fully released.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily highlighting those, but, I mean, they do give captions of how about like approximately how much of each. So fashion was only like 1%.
Oh, okay. So they kind of break it down per industry.
Yeah, so they give like an industry profile. They don't necessarily like say, oh, Toyota or Subaru and then or Cummins respond to survey, which they could have, but they don't necessarily say specifically which companies were.
So just anyone doing manufacturing. So what kinds of information are being gathered?
So there's a variety of topics that are being covered. They look at where to gauge where they see the industry. They ask about, you know, how is trade right now impacting business? So right now, trade is a big topic with a lot of market uncertainty. So that's one area they look into. They also look at labor force. You know, what is these companies seeing when it comes to the labor industry and if there's enough workers right now to meet the demands of open positions in these companies.
And then when it comes out, who's looking at it? What do they use it for?
So it comes out and it's presented. This year was presented at the Indiana Manufacturers Association. They had a reception and part of that was they presented it to the people in attendance there. But it's really, I think, from what I've talked to with some, it's really kind of for the industry to see what others are saying. So they have all industries. All companies have their own challenges going on and they put those into this. But then it kind of gives those companies a chance to see, OK, is this a bigger picture for Indiana issue or is this something maybe I'm just facing? And so it kind of gives companies a chance and the leadership in those companies to see exactly what the state's profile is a little bit more. It also gives a chance for lawmakers. There are some discussions in there, too, about is there any government policy statewide or local that could possibly be done to help these businesses grow?
Let's talk about the trends that the survey identified, starting with technology. What's been the change around technology in the last year?
Yeah, so I spoke with Mark Folks, a professor at IUPUI's Kelley School of Business, who was one of the authors of the report took the survey results, and that's what became the report here. And so what they're seeing is with technology, there's a big push and draw to it. There's this whole caption of Industry 4.0. And that at first, that doesn't necessarily ring a bell with people maybe not in that field.
But I kept seeing it come up in your report, and I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, so they look at these these revolutions in manufacturing. So it's kind of looking through the years of, you know, when electricity came online, how did that impact production and manufacturing. So there's several different steps of that. And so Industry 4.0 is looking a lot more for automation and robots that are, you know, essentially working with workers on these lines for manufacturing or even maybe taking over some of the roles that are maybe more repetitive to reduce time or save money, those type of aspects.
One of the biggest takeaways from the report is that companies are increasingly concerned that there aren't enough workers in the industry. What kind of a deficit are we looking at?
So that's where it's not fully sure. Like overall, I mean, you can look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics to kind of try to track some of it. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of questions as there's been economists who have come out saying there's a possible market slowdown. So there's questions of how that's going to play into workforce, if there's going to be as much of a demand for workers in these industries or not. But the big thing you're seeing is baby boomers are retiring. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing baby boomers retire. And when I talked to Froelich, he highlights that, as well as the fact of there is a challenge to get new, younger workers into manufacturing.
You've kind of created this leaky bucket, if you will, where you have people rightfully at the end of their careers exiting the profession and then a reluctance of others to come in.
And not only that, the unemployment rate is low. And so most people are employed.
That's correct, Matt. So that's the thing is the national unemployment level is low. And in Indiana, it's even lower. So that's making a really difficult selling point for essentially these businesses are going to have to be competitive with each other to attract a workforce to one, come to their company within a state, or even get workers to come to Indiana. And that's a part of this conversation is in the survey that asked, you know, what can be done to get people to come to the state. And one thing that was brought up was relocation tax credits, essentially. So the whole concept of the business, if this company gets a worker here, they get a tax credit, so to speak, for this person coming here. But that worker also gets a tax credit that essentially gives a benefit to attracting them to be like, oh, yeah, let's go to Indiana and work there versus maybe another state that has manufacturing.
It's a good an okay problem to have, but it's still a problem, I guess it sounds like. And the survey references the how do they put it? Industry's lack of glamour. That's part of the issue is I guess, a marketing challenge? Is manufacturing in need of a good sales pitch?
So that's a conversation that's been going on for a while, Matt. That's part of the topics I've really been pushing, that manufacturing is not the not what maybe people vision and see when they immediately think of it. It's not this dark, really dirty place to work. It's very clean, high tech. There's a lot of advanced type jobs that would not necessarily be, you're not on the line just doing the repetitive motion necessarily. There might be more where you're programming or other aspects that maybe weren't there even 20, 25 years ago. So there's this big change of really trying to educate potential workers to be like, hey, this is, it's not necessarily maybe what has been pictured before. It's changing, and this is how we want to, people to see it. So then to get people to realize there might be actual opportunities in this industry.
When we say manufacturing, that's kind of a big, broad net. Are there specific types of jobs that are experiencing shortages within the field, or is it an across-the-board problem?
So the survey really highlighted and the aspects of these companies have several divisions, but the big ones are they're seeing shortages and concerns with skilled and unskilled labor, and that's obviously a wide umbrella in itself, but those are the areas that are much more on the floor, working with the robots or not even necessarily robots, but working on the line right there with the products being manufactured compared to necessarily. They're not necessarily seeing shortages in salespeople or some of these other more marketing positions. It's these on the ground, essentially, making the products.
Speaking of increased investment in technology, there's a lot of talk around the idea of automation replacing jobs and people being out of work. How is that as we see an increase in tech and we also see a shortage of workers?
So that was an interesting aspect last year when I covered this, because last year the survey highlighted Industry 4.0 being here because they saw Indiana companies saying, oh, we are investing in technology into our manufacturing production facilities.
So and some people hear that as fewer and fewer people.
That's what some that would immediately came to mind was questions of, oh, does that mean jobs are going away? However, when I talked with the, you know, Froelich about some of the survey results, there was a much more of a idea of their jobs aren't necessarily going away. They're just transforming. They're different jobs. It's maybe you're working alongside a robot and you have to, you know how to work with it. Or maybe it's someone working to program something into the system that maybe that wasn't a job before. So there was more of a concept of the jobs are transforming, not necessarily going away at the rate maybe that people were picturing.
So are there strategies being floated on how to get more people interested in these kinds of roles, the sort of interacting with technology, new manufacturing, I suppose?
So the big thing, yeah, and that's what part of survey highlights too when I talk to Froelich, is that these state lawmakers and business leaders are really looking to other countries around the world. While we are in a competitive global market, there's also things that these leaders are looking at to other countries as success stories of possibly can we translate that here into Indiana to build the workforce here.
We might compete against them daily in terms of our products, but stepping back and learning from them, like how do you recruit young people into manufacturing and looking at apprenticeship programs in Europe and Asia and some of the things that they do.
So who are we looking at specifically? What other countries?
So I know Germany got brought up. I know they're, from what I was talking with Froelich about, they have big apprenticeship programs. And the big conversation is looking at right now, it's a lot of the focus has been on high school and building the high school pipeline into as soon as they graduate, maybe to consider going into the manufacturing industry compared to going to college instead. But what's brought up is possibly pushing that down to fourth and fifth grade, actually, to start introducing some of these concepts and ideas to then interest them then. So then in high school, there's already that awareness and the pipeline is kind of already in more formation than maybe right now.
Wow, that's really young. I mean, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but that just kind of is surprising.
It's very different than what has been traditional and what's been thought of. And I think that's what's made the survey really interesting was when they're talking about other countries and how other countries address it. You really start realizing then, is that something that Indiana manufacturing industry explores as a possibility?
Let's look at the trade war. What did we learn about how trade policy and tariffs have impacted the manufacturing sector?
So it's market uncertainty. That's the big thing with the trade wars going on. It's not just China. It's also, you know, we don't have a new the USMCA, the US-Canada-Mexico agreement has not been ratified yet, so there's not necessarily a trade policy set in stone there. And then you have Brexit happening too. So there's a lot of – a global market is really kind of right now uncertain of how things are going to shake out when it comes to these – with policies and everything else. So that's made the survey really – some of the responses that came from the survey, some of the companies said it's really hard to plan ahead. That's been a hard thing is when you think about these companies like try to make future ideas and goals about where they want to be in the next so many years. It's really hard to when you're just almost trying to be like calculating daily what the production should be at just on a short term basis because of this uncertainty.
Yeah, world governments aren't really helping out right now. What do you expect policymakers are going to take away from this report? Speaking of government.
So going back a little bit there, I think one of the notes on that when I mentioned the relocation tax credits, that's something that the survey respondents talked about as something state government could look at doing to help these businesses attract the workers here because like we talked about, it's a competitive market right now. Businesses have to figure out how to get the companies or get the workers to come here, not go to Ohio or Michigan or any other state in the country.
Let's talk about something a little adjacent to this. You're headed to Fort Wayne later today to continue covering the UAW strike, which I thought at this time last week was wrapping up or may be done by the end of the day. Last week, you updated us on a tentative agreement that needed to be voted on. Do you have any details on what the contract looked like?
So, yeah, they've released a summary now, a little bit more in detail, but it does address higher wages, health care, as well as one of the big ones that I've talked about is the path for temporary workers to a permanent employment position within GM there as a worker. So those are things that are addressed. So those are out there. Members are looking at it. They're voting right now. It's with a tentative agreement. What happened was leadership met in Detroit, voted to approve to let the rank and file members vote on this tentative agreement. And based off of those results, we'll then decide, okay, does a majority approve it? If they do, then this will be the contract that is approved. If not, then that will mean going back to the table and bargaining some more.
And forgive me if this sounds like a stupid question, but who is voting? Who is voting to approve or decline these sorts of things?
UAW members that are up to date on their dues that are currently members of their local shops that work for GM facilities. So just because UAW encompasses several different workers in different areas, so that includes other auto companies as well. So, and more even than that. But this is just the GM workers that are UAW members.
So where are we? Where are we in that process?
So today is the last day of those votes. So I believe today Fort Wayne finishes up as well as Kokomo is one of the last ones, I believe, in the nation to finish up votes. And that will be done by 2 p.m. today. So that's really soon here today.
That's really, really soon.
So then that's when the tallies have been coming in and it's going to be close. It's clearly a mixed feelings on this contract. The majority might win, but it's not going to be a landslide.
So it might go south. What happens if the vote declines the proposed contract?
So if the vote is declined, then that means it'll go back to the bargaining table. It could either be that leadership starts meets down and starts going back through the entire contract, or certain points could be highlighted and maybe certain parts and pieces are ratified. That gets a lot more complex, and I think that's where everyone's just kind of waiting to see, does this whole contract get approved or not? And then that's what next steps will happen.
Yeah, at least there's talk. At least there's talk. You've spent a lot of time reporting on the picket line these last, gosh, how many weeks? Five, six has it been? Something like that?
It's been more than five, yes.
You're like, yeah, all right, I've been there. Been there, done that. What's the sentiment among folks who remain on the picket line?
So it's mixed. It's hard, but at the same time, a lot of them are, there's been this huge push that I've talked with several about on job security. And that's where I actually, yesterday when I was in Bedford, I met with a few that were relocated to Bedford from Lordstown, Ohio, which is made a lot of headlines because it was one of the plants that GM did end up closing, and it has no plans to reopen it with this new contract. So those people have very personal connections and realities, and they're not the only ones. There's other plants that have been closed, and so job security has been a big thing on people's mind. And so I talked to Chrissy DeFelice, and that's what she said, was job security is a huge concern still with this contract.
Every plant should be worried. Lordstown wasn't the first, and Lordstown's not going to be the last plant that they close. They're in a business for themselves.
So there's a lot of, right now, that's one of the big things is that I was getting messages from workers who aren't sold on this contract, was there wasn't the security they felt that they're going to have a job going into the future. And that's what they're looking for, is they want stability.
Samantha Horton, Indiana Public Broadcasting business reporter, thank you so much for making the time today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And up next, we'll talk to Ball State University economics professor Steve Horwitz about Halloween spending and why it means the economy's not doing too bad. That's coming up. This is All In. Between seasonal decor, candy for neighborhood trick-or-treaters and costumes, even for pets, Americans are spending more on Halloween. Steve Horwitz, an economics professor at Ball State University, is with us today to tell us what increased spending around Halloween tells us. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
So how much exactly are Americans spending on Halloween?
Well, the latest numbers, the estimates anyway, for this year are about $8.8 billion total on Halloween, and that comes down to about $86 per person. So that's there's some variance there on what people are exactly spending on, but that's a healthy hunk of change.
So how many Americans are taking part in Halloween spending?
Well, that's an interesting question. The numbers have varied over time. It's in the roughly 60 to 70%, 75% range of sort of people who are doing something at least where they're spending on Halloween.
Yeah, not everybody's participating.
No, not everybody does, and people participate in different ways. I mean, the survey was anything from giving out candy to throwing a party to dressing up in all the various ways one might participate.
So what data are we learning this from?
This is a retail federation data that they track the spending for various holidays and other events around, and it's survey data, so it's people guessing what they're going to spend. It's not actually what we know after the fact. And those numbers, the 8.8 billion number is the second highest. It's down just a tick from last year. Not enough, I think, to be any kind of trend or anything. But we've seen that number climb steadily over the last decade or two.
You say various holidays. Are there any that kind of closely compare to Halloween?
Well, I was thinking about that. I think Valentine's Day in some ways is the closest one.
Right, I could see that.
And if you look at Valentine's Day, as you might expect, is a bigger deal than Halloween. Total spending on Valentine's Day is about $20 billion. The estimate from last year was about $20 billion. And that was about $162 per person. And that was a record number for Valentine's Day. And there's wild variation there. Men spend a lot more than women, perhaps not surprisingly. So we see it's some interesting trends there. One of the interesting things about Valentine's Day, there's been a drop in the number of people who celebrate or do something for Valentine's Day in the last 5 or 6 years. And it's not clear why that is. I mean, if you look at the graph, it's pretty notable drop around 2013, 2014. And I don't think anyone has a good explanation for that, but it's recovered a bit. So maybe Valentine's Day isn't as big as it used to be, but still, that's a $20 billion. It's more than twice Halloween.
Isn't that weird? Because I know that maybe this has nothing to do with it, but I know that I started dating my wife at around that time, and she does not like to celebrate Valentine's Day. Maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know.
I do think there was some speculation in the National Retail Federation discussion that, that's what it was, that the younger generation isn't as into Valentine's Day as sort of older folks were. And they had some demographic breakdown, too, and it's pretty clear it's sort of the 35 to 45-year-old group that actually is spending the most. And not surprisingly, right, these are the people who are married with kids. And for couples, right, Valentine's Day is a great excuse to say, all right, we're going to leave the kids at home. We're going to go out and do that. And if you think about those spending numbers too, I mean, the big difference is that people go out for dinner for Valentine's Day. I mean, no one's going out for dinner for Halloween, right? It's not – there's not that sort of – you know, the restaurants don't have the Halloween Day special or something like that.
Nightclubs maybe,
right,
but
right.
Not –
and you're not – and you're probably not buying your wife, you know, something special for Halloween. My wife would probably prefer that I bought her something for Halloween than for Valentine's Day.
But depends on what kind of couple
you
exactly, are, I guess.
Exactly. But yeah, so I think it's not surprising in some way we see more spending on Valentine's Day than Halloween, and that it would vary by age in that way. I think probably younger folks and then probably older folks too don't perhaps do as much with Valentine's Day. If you've been married a long time, you don't, you know, what's the argument? We don't need a special day, right? We have all, you know, we have the time, we have kids are out of the house, whatever it might be.
Okay, so we've talked about the Valentine's Day, but let's talk about Halloween. When we talk about an increase in spending, what time frame are we working within? Was this in just the last year or the last few years?
I think we've seen a steady growth, you know, over decades. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the 70s, right, where, you know, Halloween costumes, you put a old sheet on and cut a hole and you were a ghost. You know, like in the Charlie Brown specials, or you know, you were a simple witch, you put on a little makeup or something. And I certainly don't remember when I was a kid sort of the kinds of adult parties. I mean, my parents didn't go to Halloween parties the way I think that we see people do today. And so certainly if we think in terms of, say, 30, 40 years, we've seen a significant increase in how people spend on Halloween. And I didn't have a chance to look it up, but I think you probably see similar things for sort of other holidays. I mean, Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day. I mean, all these kind of holidays, right? There are people now – it's an excuse to do all kinds of fun things, and people have the resources to spend more on it than they did even a generation ago.
Do you have any data on Halloween stores and when those started to pop up? You know, those sort of seasonal pop-up Halloween stores?
I don't, but that's a really interesting question, and I think we – you know, I'm just sort of racking my own memory here. That's certainly within the last – I want to say 10 to 15 years, and certainly matches the growth in spending, right? You know, as economists would say, the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. How do you get these pop-up Halloween stores specializing in this? There's enough people who want to buy Halloween stuff, right, that you can the market can afford to support that kind of store. And yeah, I think you've seen that. It's the parallel, of course, of the fireworks stores that pop up right around 4th of July. So I think that's another sign, right, of sort of how much the spending sort of matters and the changes that we've seen. It's a great indicator, I think, of the changes we've seen in the last few decades.
Yeah, you argue that increased spending on Halloween is actually a sign of growing prosperity.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can think – there's a lot of ways you can think about it, but I think the easiest way is that we have – for most people, and again, we're always generalizing here, and there's always exceptions. But for most people, they're spending on what we think of as the basics, right? They're able to conquer that fairly easily. Just one piece of data over the very long run, roughly over the last 100 years, the percentage of people's income, household income, that's spent on food, shelter, and clothing has dropped from 75% to about half that, about 35, 40%, depending how you measure. And so when you're spending that less of a percentage of your income on the basics, you've got income to spend on other things, whether it's a smartphone or whether it's, you know, Halloween costumes and Halloween parties. So, and the other examples we might put here are the way in which, you know, birthdays and graduations and bar mitzvahs and weddings. There's this whole literature on how lavish weddings have become. We're just spending way more on those things than we ever did before. You know, some of it is kind of the keeping up with the Joneses sort of thing, but still, it's not the case that people are going heavily – most people are going heavily in debt to do those things. They have the resources to spend more on their kids than they used to and more on themselves. And so I think that's – you know, we're moving into a world where as more and more people, certainly in sort of Western market economies, are able to more easily afford the basics, they can afford to spend on these fun kind of things in ways they couldn't in the past.
And this is good news.
Yes.
Like we often hear about how people are pinned and things like that. And so when I hear something like that, like the necessities are getting cheaper or things like that, it kind of surprises me, especially when I think about the rate of inflation and how much that's
– So I think one of the things to think about here is how we talk about this. I mean, one of the most effective ways to measure this or think about this is how many hours of work does it take the typical worker to buy these sort of basic goods? And wages have gone up and prices have come down. And if you think about, you know, anything from most food, not all, but most food through the sort of basic appliances in the kitchen and household, all of these things are much cheaper, from ranging from 60 to 80% cheaper in terms of the number of hours the average person has to work. I have a great PowerPoint slide with a stereo system from 1964, right? That at the time, $1964 cost about $379. And it, if you sort of figure the hours of work it took to do that and then say, at that many hours of work, how much money would you have today? The typical person would have over $3,500 and can go into Walmart and sort of walk out with a bonanza of technology and not this sort of, you know, not so great stereo system from the early 60s. So when you think about it that way, right, I mean, the typical home has things in it that people 20, 30, 40 years ago couldn't imagine, even relatively poor Americans too, right? So, you know, there's one of the sort of quick story about this, about 70% of American households below the poverty line own a car. Okay, and that's pretty amazing when you think about it, right? And there's a story back from the 1940s when the Soviets were showing the film version of The Grapes of Wrath as propaganda, right? And the idea was it was sort of anti-capitalist propaganda, and they were hoping that the Russian audiences would take it up. And they had to stop showing it after about a week because the Russians were watching The Grapes of Wrath and sort of stopping, but wait, poor Americans have cars, right? So you know, that's – it's that kind of stuff, right, that we see, and that has grown over time. So, yeah, I mean, it is we hear these, you know, our sense is things are getting worse and worse and worse. But in reality, for most households, things are getting better, and they're able to afford Halloween, Valentine's Day, bar mitzvahs, whatever.
When you say back to the number, yeah, the 60 to 80%. Yeah. I mean, what are we comparing that to? How long has that shift taken?
From the mid 70s, right? So if you look, because people go back to about 73, and they say that's, you know, early 70s, everything was kind of great back then. And in fact, you know, there's some of the data on sort of productivity and wages starts to change around then. And so people sort of point to that. I mean, I was alive in the early 70s. You know, it wasn't so great, right? I joke with my students, right? We had TVs. Not all of them had color, right? And the remote control was, you know, you threw something at your brother and said, go change the channel. So and certainly we didn't have 500 channels to choose from either. And those improvements, I think, that we see are sort of from the 70s forward are just amazing. And we take it – we don't recognize it. It happens slowly and we don't see it over time. But when you stop and think about what life was like back then compared to now, the change is significant.
So this signifies an increase in prosperity across the board. We're not just talking about a specific income level.
No, right. Across the board, right? I mean, you know, and even, again, I think if you look at the data on what people have in their households, right? There's Census Bureau does survey data on this and ask people, do you have a refrigerator? Do you have a fridge? All these sorts of things. And you look at the percentage of households that have this, and you see it growing on average. And today, American households below the poverty line today are more likely to own most of those things than the average American household was in the 70s. I mean, air conditioning, for example, and other kinds of things. Of course, the one thing that's fallen are telephones, because now they have cell phones, right? So you know, those kind of changes are remarkable. And even things – I love – there's a one stat about, you know, go to the 70s, nobody owned a VCR. And then you look in the 80s and 90s, everybody owned VCR. Now no one owns a VCR anymore, right? And then we're going to see the same thing with DVD players and Blu-ray and all the rest as streaming and so forth takes over. So, you know, those changes are just incredibly significant. And what they've enabled us to do is to have that disposable income to spend on more on fun, right? And that's and we see that in, you know, with the new Star Wars coming out and all this other – in the Marvel movies. You know, people say, oh, movies are so expensive today. Well, yeah, they are, but they're awesome, right? I mean, technologically awesome, and that's what people have the money to spend on.
I imagine this increase in disposable spending has a significant impact on the job market too.
Well, and it's certainly – right, things have shifted. And one of the reasons – so the process here, right, is a lot of the material goods that we consume are made with less labor than they used to be. Automation and all these other things have made those production processes less labor intensive. And so, you know, where do those workers go? Well, they end up going to these other places that we're spending on, the Halloween pop-up stores, producing movies, all these other kinds of things. And the shift we're seeing now is a parallel to the same shifts we've seen in the past when farming got mechanized and more productive and people shifted to factories and industrialization. And now we're shifting away from that into this sort of knowledge production and entertainment production and these sorts of things. And this obviously ties into the concerns we've seen in the political debates about automation and so on. But human beings will never run out of things we want, right? And so we get better – the better we get at producing things without human labor, the more human labor we have to produce the other stuff that we want. And I think that's part of what we've seen here.
You've talked about pet costumes.
Oh.
I associate pet costumes being a niche commodity.
Yeah.
I remember, though, a trip to Target, at least half an aisle there dedicated to dressing up our dogs.
It's, right. And now we have PetSmart and Petco. We got whole stores, right, dedicated to this. And this is the – as I looked at this data, it was stunning to me. People spend about $500,000, $490 million at Halloween on their pets, right? That's a relatively small percentage of that $8.8 billion. But still, that's half a billion dollars on their pets. And then Valentine's Day, people spent almost $1 billion, $886 million total on their pets for Valentine's Day. And that's like, what are you – are you taking the cat out for a seafood dinner? What are you buying? What are you doing for your dog? Are you giving your fish special Valentine's fish? I have a dog, and I'm just not sure what people are doing with spending for Valentine's Day on their pets, but they're doing it. And you can make a broader point here about pets, right? I mean, we spend way more on our pets than people ever did in the past. We can afford to. I think what's kind of cool about that is that it reflects a growth in our humanity in a certain sort of way too, right? The nice thing about getting richer is you can afford to indulge your concern for not just other human beings but for other creatures too. And the way we take care of our pets and the way we treat pets like family now, I think, is great, and it's a consequence of that wealth.
What would you say to people who hear you suggesting that we have more prosperity, but we also then hear about the high rates of debt across the country?
Yeah.
How can we be richer but also have more debt?
Well, so, there's two ways of thinking about debt. You can think about the absolute amount of debt that people have. So, $20,000 in credit card debt plus a car loan or whatever it might be. And those absolute numbers are greater than they used to be, and they're scary sounding sometimes. But what matters to households is what's the burden that debt imposes on them. If you're a relatively wealthy household, $20,000 in a car loan isn't as big a deal as if you're a middle class or working class household. And so what we've seen happen is, again, as this sort of prosperity has increased, people are able to take on more debt than they were in the past. So even though the absolute amount of debt has grown, the burden that it imposes on households is about the same as it was in the 50s. And the nature of that debt's changed, right? There's more credit cards are more commonplace in the way that they weren't, say, 40, 50 years ago. So there's credit card debt, and certainly college debt is a problem, though more localized than I think the media often makes it seem. So those are different kinds of debt compared to things in the past. But again, people can afford that debt in ways they couldn't before. And I would add that, things like housing and cars, which are two of the big things we borrow for, what we're getting for that is much better than it used to be. Cars are much, the cost has gone up, but the value and the length of time you get out of a car is incredible. Cars, the old days, I remember as a kid, if your car turned 100,000 miles, like, that was celebration. Now, if you don't get 100,000 miles out of your car, right, you feel like you bought a lemon. So I think, we have to always adjust for quality when we think about these changes in costs over time and why people might take on more absolute debt.
Finally, how else do we see the impacts of increased prosperity in a nation touch our daily lives? Do we see the consequences of this trend in places beyond the checkout counter?
I think so. I mean, I think that we, we can generalize a point that I made before. I think prosperity enables us to indulge, to spend on and to sort of care about, and I didn't care about, to execute, to actually turn our care into something material for lots of values, higher values that we wouldn't otherwise. I mean, one of the best examples is environmental concerns, right? I mean, when you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you are not too concerned about how clean the environment is and these sorts of things. Folks who know Maslow's hierarchy can think in those terms. Right? When you satisfy the basic needs, now you can afford to spend on these other kinds of things. And the economic evidence on environmental stuff is quite clear, that as societies get richer, they're willing and able to spend more on keeping that world clean. And so there's another example, right, of what prosperity can help produce.
Steve Horwitz, economics professor at Ball State University. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you missed a show, get the podcast wherever you find podcasts. Join us Monday when we'll recap the state Supreme Court hearings that took place this week and indeed are taking place as we speak surrounding groping allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill. I'm Matt Pelzer. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. This is All In.